What up, y'all, and welcome to In the Bush Podcast with Cole and Joel. This is episode number 5 with Joel Turner. We have such a great talk with Joel. We talk about hunting blacktail deer. We talk about life. We talk about Shot IQ, which is a company that Joel developed, and so much more. Just there was so much that we dove into this conversation, and I hope you guys love it so much. But before we do that, this episode is brought to you by BushSurvivalTraining.com. Go check out the website there. There is courses that you can sign up for in person, and there's also a survival course that you can grab for $25. Also, leave us an email. Get in contact with us. Heck, follow us on this podcast and leave us a 5-star review. It helps us so much, y'all. Just want to thank you, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. I want to jump right into this podcast because it is so good and it's jam-packed, full of great conversation. Thank you again, and here's episode number 5 with Joel Turner. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to In the Bush Podcast with Joel and Cole. And Joel, actually.
Joel Turner.
Yeah, we've got two. This is going to be
Joels. I don't know if the world's ready.
Know if the world's ready. It's so funny because when I grew up, I never ever met another kid with my name, and I moved to the States, and now everyone's got the name Joel. But Mr. Joel Turner, it is so good to have you. Founder of Shot IQ. Your specialty is coaching people to deal with target panic. I have spent time with you doing some private training, which was hugely helpful in that regard. Also a very accomplished hunter, and is a 2-time world elk calling champ.
Yep.
Is that accurate? Perfect.
That's accurate.
That's accurate. So I just, first of all, want to thank you for coming onto the podcast. Second of all, I want to thank you for dealing with my texts that, Joel, what? I got these blacktail and I'm coming out in daylight. Like, what would you do? Would you hunt this part of the season or that part of the season? Like, how would you call? And just the little tidbits that you've given me have been hugely helpful. I just, you know, guys like you and James Nash, and then of course, Cole, you know, my closest buddy, like it really has affected me so much in a positive way in my hunting. And so to have you to come onto the podcast and share a bit more of that knowledge is greatly appreciated.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
So
super excited.
Yeah.
Let's go back just a second. So, Joel, big time blacktail hunter. Are you a rattler? Do you like to call to them?
I do. I love calling everything. Like, yes, I started calling elk when I was 12 years old, and I love hunting things that make noise. That's why elk are my favorite, obviously. But blacktails are so mysterious, and when you really get close to them, they actually make quite a bit of noise. And I've done some rattling for blacktails. I've killed a few bucks rattling, but mostly the way that I kill them now is fawn bleats.
And so those fawn bleats, are you doing those? Because I know you've sent me a video when I asked you once on doing bleats with a elk mouth reed.
Right.
Is that what you use?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been very close to fawns when they're, you know, just when you're hunting, if you call one in, just like calling in a calf elk. They've got a very specific rasp to their voice that's difficult to make on some calls, but it's very effective, and especially in the rut, it's very effective. Last week of October, it's money.
Okay, so you don't have to divulge the sound on here, but okay. I might need your phone number because when I come up,
I strongly disagree. We need the sound,
dude. Because that's like that's one of those things, like Joel, like you talk about, like whenever I rattle for whitetail, all the different things that I do that doesn't even entail smashing horns together. You know what I mean? Like these are absolutely. These are little details that make you so effective in your pursuit.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Yeah, so I want to give Joel a bit of a, just a little bit of insight to you. So Cole is an incredible caller. He's not like the most technically savvy caller, I'd say, but he just knows when to call. And so he's killed numbers of bucks by calling them in whitetails and then elk. I mean, he's all about calling, and he's obviously rubbed off on me so much. And I'm really inspired by calling because of you two. So
Cole, have you called in a lot of blacktails or just mostly
whitetails? So I haven't got to pursue blacktail yet, but I do pursue whitetail throughout all of October, November, and December, throughout all stages, you know, of the rut. So it's really fun to me to come out of being, you know, having my ass handed to me during elk season and then go into whitetail season and, you know, get to have some encounters, like, you know, just those awesome deer encounters. Cause deer, when deer come in, they come in with just, you know, they just blow through. It's not like an elk sometimes. They just come smashing through everything and come right up into your grill. And it's super exciting. So I've told Joel, I was like, we have to nail down a time for me to come up there during the rut, because I want to come rattle for them and call and really get out there and just tromp through the woods and, you know, make a bunch of noise. And
it's a vastly different experience between whitetails and blacktails. Like, whitetails are very susceptible to calling. The densities are so much heavier that you can, you know, you can do several calling setups in a day and have results on each one of those setups. But blacktails, it's a whole other ball game. Yeah. Like, you might call in one buck in 10 days.
Oh, wow.
So
that's what I've heard. And that's what I've experienced.
Yeah. It's totally different. The deer densities are so low, but in Oregon, there it's way better than in Washington. Washington, where I'm at now, it's way different. Like, we hunt blacktails in the high country in late November, when we're in 3 feet of snow, 3-4 feet of snow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where they're dragging their bellies through the snow, making trails through it. And in high country, you know, old growth timber, stuff like that, because the elevation's got a lot to do with when they rut. You know, the biologists are telling us it's all based on body condition now. So 23% body fat is what a doe has to get to before she'll go into estrus. So your lower elevation deer will go into rut much earlier. Like, we're hunting them, like, we hunt them really heavy starting on the 22nd of October.
Yeah.
To the 31st, because our season, our rifle season ends on the 31st of October, and it's 22nd of October to the 31st is the magical time for this elevation, which is anywhere from, you know, sea level to 2,000 feet.
Gotcha.
You get up to 2,000 feet and the rut starts to get later and later to the
later.
Point.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, in Texas, we basically have two different ruts. We have a north and a south zone. In deep south Texas, our rut will carry on through into February most of the times.
Yeah, I hope you're not seriously disappointed when you get to the blacktail states, because it's nothing like Texas, bro.
No, no doubt. I mean, there's nothing, there's nowhere like Texas, Oklahoma, like Texas. Some of these whitetail states.
Sure.
I've been up into the blacktail woods with Joel a little bit and got to poke around during the summer, and I was surprised actually at how much sign we were able to pick up.
A lot of rubs in the bedding.
Yeah, it was rut sign. You could tell that it was some aggression rubs and maybe them rubbing out velvet, but it was definitely a distinguished rut. It looked like a rub line.
Blacktails do love to rub, and when they rub an area, they destroy it.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely destroy it, but that's usually at night. You never really get to see that activity.
That's the thing. They're so nocturnal.
Yeah.
So nocturnal. But I have, every season I hunt the same area every season. It's roughly 2,000 to 3,000 feet. And I do notice that the rut tends to be 15th November ish is kind of this when I usually set my calendar for when things start to kick off, depending on the weather. And if I've noticed too, that the bucks in certain areas tend to to be more visible in those early hours when the weather is nice and still. When the weather is bad, they tend to, I don't know, they're just much harder to see. However, the does are everywhere when the weather is bad. You know, like that rainy, you could hunt all day in that sort of weather. But then I figured out where these bucks were bedding down, and that changed the game. I killed my first blacktail buck with a bow this with a stick bow this year, and it last day of the season, of course. But I put a couple of those pieces of the puzzle together and realized that they really are bedding down, just like the typical deer thing. They're bedding down in that top third of mostly south-facing slopes. And so still hunting that bedding, getting on those trails, and then contouring along those trails until you bump into the bedding is now my new tactic of choice. However, I really want to get on these trails where I can really find some fresh sign and then put more attention into rattling, or like you say, using doe bleats.
Yeah, I would do now doe bleats. For blacktails are super quiet. Have you ever heard a blacktail doe bleat?
I have, yeah, under my tree stand around 10 feet, so quiet.
It's
So
almost
quiet.
inaudible. The fawns are much louder. But doe bleats, like, I don't know. I feel like when I'm out there doing bleating, it's like when I do a doe bleat, I'm like, there's no way anything heard that. It's so quiet, you know. So that's why I tend to stay on the fawn spectrum.
Gotcha. So you can get a little louder. And are you a big bedding hunter, or are you more of a transition zone hunter? Or you know, what do you think about hunting animals in their bed?
Well, I mean, the blacktails usually bed in such nasty country. If you have a lot of contour where you can get up above them, they're almost always facing downhill. So if you can work ridge lines and go up the very tip of the ridge and then just keep peeking over, you'll catch them, you'll catch them 40 yards below the ridge, bedded, looking downhill. So that's one of the ways that we hunt them here, but it's not massively productive. But I mean, when we do get them, that's kind of how we get them as well. So
So what would be your ultimate strategy then for hunting blacktail? Like how do you plan out your hunt? Meaning like when you're literally stepped out of the vehicle, boots on the ground, are you getting to a tree stand or blind mostly, or are
tree
you
stands. Yeah,
okay?
I love hunting out of tree stands, but it's so random. I mean, blacktails don't follow trails that much. They don't follow any pattern of time of day. They're very nocturnal. So all the bucks that I've killed, or a lot of the bucks that I've killed, have been in the last 5 minutes of legal shooting time. And I get on, if you do use bait, you're probably not going to kill a giant on bait. You will kill a giant 100 yards from bait when they scent check it. So it's about setting up a bait station where it's legal to do so, and then getting off that bait at least 100 yards so you're outside the circle. So when they do their wind arc around that bait site, because they're checking for does, that's when you get them. So you got to kind of figure out where a place where either they can't get behind you, or you're so far out of the circle, like you're 30 yards farther than their circle, to where, when they're doing their wind check, then you can shoot them that way. Usually, bait sites will bring in does and small bucks, but if big bucks come in there, it's all nocturnal and it's not usually to eat. It's just to check for doe scent. So setting up that bait site is important if you're going to do that, but don't hunt the bait itself. Hunt 100 yards around it. Some circle, figure out with your terrain, your foliage, all that stuff. Maybe you've got a cliff edge. Maybe you can get up against that to where they can't get around you. Some natural funnels that funnel them in this 100-yard circle around the bait site. That's kind of what you're looking for.
That's really interesting. I never even considered that. If you're not using bait or salt or anything, would you try then to get up as close to bedding to set up your tree stand so that you catch them ho hopefully just as they return to bedding when you got a little bit of daylight left?
Yeah, I mean, they're feeding everywhere they go. They're eating blackberry leaves. I don't know what they eat down there, but up here, blackberry leaves, especially later in the season. So, you can do the bedding thing. If you know where they're feeding, or if you got some big blackberry patches or whatever, you can certainly be off of that between feeding and bedding. But it's just been so doggone random with blacktails. Like, I hunted whitetails in Montana this year at my place, and it was night and day. I mean, in 3 weeks of sitting in the tree stand, I saw 26 different bucks
Oh,
come through
jeez.
there. And it was, I was calling them. I found snort wheezing for those Montana whitetails is phenomenal.
Oh,
Snort, yeah.
that's
Better
my
than
jam.
rattling. It was better than anything. Snort wheeze just turned them on a dime and in they would come.
It's exactly what you've told me, Cole. How
Well,
many
it's a very
bucks have you
aggressive
called
call.
them?
I mean, whenever they make that noise, it's straight up like they're fixing to fight another deer. Like they're basically telling them that you better get away from my, whatever's going down right then. Sometimes it's just them being a bully and like, don't get close to me. Sometimes it has to do with the doe being in the area whenever they bust that snort wheeze out, man. And it's deadly. Like I told you, Joel, I use it before I rattle ever. Like I'll do a couple of grunts and some doe bleats and stuff, and then I'll hit that snort wheeze, and it just sets the scene that we're, almost like a breeding sequence whenever you're doing like elk calling, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, just
You
setting that
called in what?
scene.
You in Oklahoma this year, you called 14 bucks in?
Yeah, 14 into like
Yeah.
40 into about 40 yards. I finally
So for the yeah,
I
like for
finally
the listeners, this
harvested
is
mine
so effective.
I harvested mine the last evening and it was like 15 yards. Shot it with a longbow.
Yeah. And so Joel, I followed you this last elk season.
Oh,
Really, really enjoyed your posts. It was ridiculous. You made it
man.
look like you're hunting an elk sanctuary.
Yeah.
I mean, how many bulls did you call in?
54.
54. And the
Wow.
worst part about it was your hunting partner Seth, right? Seth.
Yeah.
I mean, these bulls are coming and he's like, "No, not good enough." And I'm like, "God, I would give my left arm to take that bull."
Well, where we got to hunt was right by our place here in Eatonville, and it's a tag that it took him a long time to draw, and it's just a totally random draw, but he's been putting
Yeah.
in 20 some years on it. And
Wow. Okay.
so finally it was his turn, I guess, and you can take one person in there with you, and of course he took me in there, and it was a blast. Gosh, he killed the 29th bull that I called in for him.
Wow.
Yeah, I
I
ended up
mean,
calling him 30 bulls,
experience.
but he killed the 29th one, and as he was working out, I called another one in, so
That's incredible.
That's awesome.
Just to have those encounters that many times. I mean, what an experience. I mean, what an experience as far as like the enjoyment and the engagement, but also literally the amount of experience that you gain in or an affirmation you gain in calling in 30 bulls kind of back to back over the season. That's incredible.
Yeah, that was in 10 days.
In
So,
10 days.
yeah, 10 days we called in 30, and it got down to the point where these bulls became very protective but shy. They did not want to mess with other bulls. So Seth being, I mean, Seth is an absolute blacktail killing machine. He has the patience like I've never seen before. When he moves through the woods, when Seth still hunts, it's like a ghost. It's like he's levitating over the ground. I mean, he doesn't make any noise, but so what I do then is now I just keep those bulls bugling and Seth just ghosts right in on them.
Just sneaks in,
He
huh?
just floats in and that bull is just losing his mind. He may not want to come in all the way, but he's just losing his mind in there. So it makes it easy for Seth to just slip in on him.
It is incredible how elk, when they're looking for an elk because they hear an elk, they expect to see an elk. They don't see that human silhouette just isn't like on their radar, and it's sort of like you're transparent as long as you don't move too much.
Right. Yeah. And they're so,
Incredible.
the way that I do it, they're so pissed off that they've literally lost their mind. So.
Oh, that's phenomenal. So the one last question, just jumping back to blacktail. You mentioned it, and I think this is probably the frustration of all blacktail hunters is getting those mature bucks in daylight hours. Do you find that there's a sweet spot in with the rut and maybe in combination with weather, with the moon, anything like that where you've noticed for sure that they tend to be more mobile and active in daylight hours?
We kill most of our bucks on October 28th.
Huh.
Year after year after year, the 28th of October has been phenomenal. But the daylight activity really starts up on the 22nd. I mean, you're starting to see bucks everywhere,
Okay.
like ones you never thought existed. Oh, there he is. Like the buck that Bodie killed this year,
That's so crazy.
we'd never seen that deer before. And
Wow.
these are fairly urban deer, but we've never seen this deer before. And Bodie killed it on the first day we witnessed it. So
So October 28th. So are you hunting? You're obviously hunting archery, but are you hunting during the rifle season then? Okay.
absolutely. Yeah.
Like any
So if
legal
I
weapon
in
season.
Washington, you can draw a multi-season tag, which allows you to hunt the archery season, the muzzleloader season, and rifle season.
Oh,
But
God,
if you
that's great.
don't, if I don't draw that multi-season tag, then I buy a rifle tag usually,
Okay.
just to hunt
Okay.
those. The last days of October is for us at this elevation is money.
That's cool. Okay,
That's
that's
so
awesome.
crazy
Awesome.
because I keep track whenever, because I like to rattle for whitetail in October. I pretty much start about October 15th, but I've never rattled in a whitetail buck and killed one until October 28th. That's so wild. Yeah. Something about
It's a magical day, and everybody talks about Halloween. You got to be in the Blacktail Woods on Halloween.
Yeah, I was going to say the 28th to Halloween is like some of my best times. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
cool.
it's true. You got to get them before they lock down with those, because once they do that, it's you're not gonna. They stay in the thickest, nastiest, and they just stay on that doe. So.
They're a very humbling animal. There's kind of, I think the alluring fact for me about them is the terrain that they're in is just so enchanted. Like it literally feels like you're in ghostly woods, and it's so dark and eerie. And I love the energy in the woods, in the Blacktail Woods. And the fact is, when usually when you see them, they're pretty close in stick bow range. So that's one of the benefits, right? But they do take a lot of patience. But I kind of have a easier time sitting in a stand in those type of woods than I would do in like more of the open sagebrush type country. There's just something that's spectacular about it.
Yeah, and I mean, when you're there and it's starting, you're looking at your watch like, okay, I got 10 minutes of legal shooting time left. And then you catch that glimpse like, oh man, here they come. They're coming around that 100-yard circle to check for does or whatever. It's pretty intense. And then when you got the white face on those things, you're in the dark timber in the ferns and the moss and the alder trees, and then all of a sudden you see that white face. You don't see anything else but that white face. They're so camouflaged, but that white face gives them away, and it's so incredible.
It's so incredible. And their antlers, man, that like they have like a red hue to the antlers. It's they're just absolutely beautiful. I am in love with those animals.
That's cool.
Okay, so Joel, so let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned you like to sit up in tree stands. And it kind of reminds me of one of the posts I had seen of yours the other day, which I really gravitated towards because I get it. And that was silence. You had made a post about the silence. It brought me right back into the Northwest Territory in Canada when I was on season 7 of Alone. And it was so quiet out there that it actually was a little bit bothersome, like a little bit unnerving for the first week or so. And then when I adjusted to that silence, I just, like you say, my mind, or it was like a switch had been flipped in my mind, and all of a sudden I could focus, I could think, and I could really get introspective about a variety of things in my life. And it just came to me. And so I really value the silence. And so I guess my question is, that's something obviously is that something that you value in your hunting experiences? Is that time alone in silence?
It is priceless to be in a place, and this where I was at when I did that post was on a family piece of property in Montana. And we'd had some predator issues with killing some cattle. And so I was sitting out there over a dead carcass that these predators had killed. And I figured it would be better at night. So it was so cold out there. And but you know, I first noticed it 2 years ago when I was elk hunting in this area, and I was out helping the family rancher there, and I was splitting wood for him. And I'm out there just whacking away on these pine logs, and I stopped for a second and I noticed there was no sound whatsoever. And I mean, this is literally at the edge of the Rocky Mountains. And it's heavy grizzly bear country. And it's just incredibly beautiful. But the silence is the treasure there. And like when I was out there the other, I sat out there for 3 nights. And, my new brand called Mind IQ, we talk about thoughts aren't thinking, right? So thoughts are what you hear. Thinking is what you say. And when you run into a problem creates an increase in the volume of thoughts. But thoughts have no instruction. Thoughts have no strategy, right? Thinking is the embodiment of both of those things. And so we can't adjust the volume of our thoughts, but you can always adjust the volume of your thinking. So when you're out there in absolute silence, the volume of your thoughts is not as loud. And so your thinking, your voice, has to be the loudest one in the room, but that's easy to do when it's silent, right? So you find that clarity in those silent places, and then you take that clarity to the noisy places of your life. I've branched into professional sports now, so I'm training people that concept, thoughts aren't thinking, and the mental game equation, and how to actually think. And then when you do something and you succeed, have you blueprinted how you did it so that you can build your toolbox and actually go into that toolbox in those high stress, noisy places of your life? So it's a fascinating place to be in that silence, and you've been there, right? So
I
I
love
love
what you're saying. I mean,
yeah.
the one thing, Joel, the one thing I love about you is that you are so introspective, but you've got the gift to be able to take that introspective thought and that realization that you've had, and you're able to articulate it in a way that just makes sense. That's not something I think that can be trained to most. I think that that's something it's a God-given gift. And you say it and you make it sound so simple because it is simple. But for others to be able to think that and then articulate it to others, it's going to sound like mumbo jumbo,
Well, so that's what I've done is really, I consider myself the master of the unknown obvious, because we do things, but we don't realize how we do them. So therefore, we cannot harness the power of what we're doing. And so, like when I was on the Rogan podcast, and Rogan was talking about how what we do at Shot IQ is applicable to everything else in life, I'm like, I really like your thinking, Joe, but I don't have the words for that right now. So it wasn't until about 3 weeks later when somebody asked me, can you define the mental game? And I'm like, well, the mental game of what? And that person said, that's all I'm asking. So that's when I had to look deep and get introspective, as you say, and I had to go, what is the mental game that we're trying to figure out here? Because people talk about it all the time. Oh, I'm working on my mental game. I'm practicing the mental game of whatever problems they're having. But it's just, they have no idea where the stadium is. They don't know who the players are. They don't know the rules of the game, so they can't possibly win it. So I had to figure out where is the stadium, right? Who are the players? What are the rules of this game? so that we can win it. And that's where we came up with the mental game equation. Knowing when, where, and how to direct your conscious mind into a specific task at a specific moment. That is literally the mental game of life.
Can you say that again? That
it's,
last sentence.
It's knowing when, where, and how to direct your conscious mind into a specific task at a specific moment.
Yes.
Yeah. So like when I go talk to folks, like I'm going on Tuesday to your hometown in Redmond to talk to 60 construction supervisors. I'm not a construction supervisor. I don't need to be. I went and trained the Philadelphia Phillies pitching team. Who am I? I'm not a major league pitcher, but I'm an expert in the mental game. So I'm able to go into these places and extract people's problems. Like, what is your problem that you're dealing with right now? And then I'll ask the question, what's the mental game of that problem? And that never gets answered. It's always silence when I ask that. What's the mental game of that? What's the mental game of your anxiety attack? What's the mental game of throwing that baseball into the catcher's mitt? What's the mental game of getting your employee to do a certain task that they're fighting you on, right? Those are just merely problems. Problems increase the volume of thoughts. Like, why can't this person get this? That statement has no instruction and it has no strategy attached to it. So you have to figure out where to put the conscious mind, when to put it there, and the how is always speech. Speech is always the vehicle that moves thoughts from the limbic system of the brain to the prefrontal cortex where thinking occurs. It's always been speech. We've always talked ourselves through things, but we don't remember what we say. So when it comes to that high stress event again, your toolbox is empty.
So you would say speech helps like induce focus.
Speech is the embodiment of concentration. It is of your conscious mind, right? Remember, thoughts are what you hear. Thinking is what you say. It's got to be your voice and it's got to be the loudest one in the room. So when you're shooting your bow, if you're shooting let's say you're shooting a compound with a release aid, where do we need your conscious mind? Let's plug the problem is you're punching the trigger. Let's plug it into the equation. Where do you need your conscious mind? You need it in your trigger work. When do you need it there? Specifically, you need it there after you've aimed, after you've addressed the trigger, and after you've said, here I go. So that's your moment of truth within one archery shot. And then how do you get your conscious mind into the trigger work? Speech, right? That's how we do it. It's how we all do it. We all talk ourselves through things, right? Like Cole, if you calling in a big buck, right? And you're like, oh my God, there he is. Holy mackerel, that thing's a 180, right? That is nothing more than a problem, right? You saying it's a 180 has nothing to do with you working through your shot process on the deer.
Yeah.
Those are thoughts, right? Thinking would be, I'm going to draw back and aim. Then I'm going to tension up. Then I'm going to say, here I go. Then I'm going to add some tension, right? That's all thinking. That is all instruction. Self-instruction and self-talk are two completely different things. Because if you look up the definition of self-talk, a lot of those definitions are negative. Oh man, I'm not good enough. Why is this happening to me? That's all self-talk.
100%. I think that's most people around the world would have that kind of self-talk.
Right. They're not doing self-instruction. Why would you ever instruct yourself to a negative end?
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that that's probably where you see most of the failure go down right there, isn't it? Once you get in that mindset of you know, talking yourself down rather than putting yourself in the situation or telling yourself you can and you are and you will, you know, is a lot different than saying I'm about to screw this up, right?
Right, and that's where a lot of people are stuck. But even if you are a positive person, like, yeah, I'm going to do this. Well, if you don't know how you're going to do it, it's a fleeting moment in time. If you do succeed at it, you didn't blueprint it. So it's a fleeting moment in time. So like when I shoot my bow, when I shoot my longbow, I know I'm going to draw back and aim. That's not a mystery to me. And when I'm doing that, that's all I'm doing. I know I'm going to tension up next. it's not a mystery to me. I know that's what I'm doing, right?
Yeah.
And that's all I'm doing when I tension up. I know that I'm going to say, here I go. It's a decision that increases presence, remember?
Yeah.
Right? So I'm going to say, here I go. And then I'm going to work myself through my mechanoreceptive trigger. My shot is not a mystery. I'm doing it every single time, no yeah. matter what. So that may be an archery shot. It may be an anxiety attack. It may be an anger management issue. It may be throwing a baseball. It might be shooting a free throw. It's either a cerebral problem or it's a movement problem. It's the same mental game. It just has different values that you plug into the equation.
Right? You know, when I came and I did that private training with you, you asked me a question. Well, there was two things which really stick out to me. You know, the first one was you had me write my name mm-hmm. down between on lined paper, and I had to write my name down with the top and the bottom of my name touching.
Be careful talking about this is secret sauce.
This is secret stuff. Okay,
let's not talk too much about the secret.
Okay, let's not talk too much. Bottom line is, I did this test, and you told me that I'm a determined person. Mm-hmm. Which I appreciated, but it also was confusing. Mm-hmm. But after the instruction down the line, I don't find it confusing anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, you asked me at the same time, you said, how do you focus? How do you concentrate? Like, how do you actually do it? I fumbled. Like, I did. I was like, well, you just do it. Like, no. Yeah. How do you explain to me exactly how you do it? And obviously now I get it. I get, you know, it is that self-talk. It's you know, target panic, I've realized since your instruction, is literally just a breakdown of focus. That's all it is. It's just a complete breakdown of focus.
It's playing the wrong mental game, because think about this in archery instruction. For decades, it has been, the focus has been on aiming.
And yep.
So you plug your archery shot into the mental game equation. And if you put the where do you need your conscious mind? If you put it in aiming, when do you put it there? And most people start aiming before they even draw their longbow back, right? How do you put it there? Speech, remember the old pick a spot sticker, or you say, I'm going to burn a hole in it, whatever. You are putting your conscious mind in a place that cannot help you, because the subconscious will run the rest of the shot and it won't let you get to tension. It won't usually let you get to full draw. Right. And it won't let you get to your aim, because being on the target equals an explosion. And based on the science of visual proprioception, your movement of your arrow, your gap, however you shoot instinctive, don't see arrow, I don't care. It's always coming back to the center of whatever sight picture you've chosen. It's the same way you drive. You're not driving, weaving all over the roadway, right? If your vehicle starts getting close to the center line, you'll do an automatic corrective movement on the steering wheel. And that, right? You'll move
Absolutely.
The steering wheel until you get the right visual feedback. And when you find yourself in the back in the center of the lane, then that movement stops, then it goes the other way. It's all based on visual feedback. So putting your conscious mind into vision is wasted energy. It's the wrong values in the mental game. So that's where people screw up. Like, think about this. I trained a high school basketball team a while back because I was noticing that they were missing a lot, especially their free throws. They were horrible. And so I went in and I chatted with them, and I asked this one young female, I said, what do you say to yourself when you shoot a free throw? And she says, well, I say follow through. I'm like, okay. So if you say follow through, remember that a shooting a basketball is a fast movement. It's faster mm-hmm. than you can gain feedback within it. It's open loop. It's supposed to be yeah. open loop. So if you say something about the movement, and the movement's supposed to be open loop, you have put your conscious mind, or you've tried to inject it into an open loop motor program, and it kills the totality of the movement. So in open loop movements, like most sports movements, you have to keep your conscious mind out of the movement.
Gotcha. And which would apply to archery too, right? Like, it just in specific instances.
Well, on a moving target, yes.
Yeah.
All right.
But
So the difference between like my compound and my traditional bow is a totally different shot process because I can go through my whole process, right, of doing all the things. And I've listened to like a lot of your podcasts, Joel, and I've got it, I talk myself through and it's perfect, right? But whenever I get into my traditional bow, it's a different thing because it's almost like I've got to tell myself to shoot the bow and not worry so much about the process of aiming it. Does that make sense?
So aiming is the same. It doesn't seem the same because with your compound, you're probably shooting with sights, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so your sights set your arrow on a trajectory path. In shooting your trad bow, your eyes set your arrow on a trajectory path.
Okay.
It's just aim and get it done, right? Draw back and aim. Don't hover and don't linger in the aiming room. Just get it done. Don't move your pin slowly from the bottom or slowly from the top. Just if you know it's 30 yards and you got a 30 yard pin, stick your 30 yard pin on it. That's only job number one in the shot. But it's the same thing with your trad bow. Draw back and get the aim done, right? But in trad shooting, because the volume of thoughts are so much louder because you're holding so much more weight, that's a problem, right? It causes an increase in the volume of thoughts. And because your subconscious is always trying to push you toward efficiency, you've blended a bunch of steps that you have to keep separate, right?
Interesting. I never thought about that. So you say that because of the, let's say, the increased strain required with drawing back a trad bow, it's going to increase your mental activity.
It increases the volume of thoughts. So
Okay.
you have to increase the volume of your thinking, which is your voice, and it's got to be the loudest one in the room of your mind, right? The room of your head. So when you have that distraction or when your volume of your thoughts increases in whatever problem you're dealing with, you have to start to recognize that and increase the volume of your thinking because that's the only way you solve a problem. Thoughts don't solve problems. Thinking solves problems.
What do
They're
you say though to the guys that just literally don't cannot get control of their mind when they have whatever a big bull standing right there, pissing himself, just frothing and angry, and he's right there, and they literally cannot get their mind straight.
It's because they're not even attempting to get their mind straight. They're relying on their training that they've practiced all year long for this one shot, but they've practiced their failure every single shot in practice. Because they're not totally controlling their shots in practice, they're literally practicing, excuse me, literally practicing their own failure. Like
Gotcha.
when I shot that giant bull this year, I'd seen that bull the day before, and then I saw him on the day that I killed him, and the closest I'd been to that bull is 600 yards. And then when I finally called him in on the last setup, bull calling cow's bugle when he was raking the tree, he stops raking the tree. I'm like, oh, he's coming. And the GoPro video tells the entire story of what's going through my head. I do a head check. You'll see the camera kind of move a little bit. And that's when I saw him at 30 yards. I'm like, oh my God, that thing is a monster. Biggest bull I've ever seen, ever dealt with. I mean, it was
Wow.
just an absolute giant. And to see him at 30 yards, I'm like, oh my God, that's him. That thing is huge, right? Those statements are thoughts.
Thoughts.
They have no instruction, they have no strategy, right? So I see him, I tuck my head back, I lift my bow up. I forgot for a moment that I was shooting a compound. You see it in the video. I lift my bow up and I've just got it pointed in his direction. He hasn't come around the corner of the tree yet. And I'm sitting there waiting because the last, since 2009, I've shot all my bulls with a stick bow, right? I've killed a lot of bulls between 2009 and now with a stick bow.
Yeah, and so for the listeners, meaning with a compound, you can draw back and you've got plenty of time to wait.
Yeah,
With
you can
a stick
hold the
bow,
thing
you
back,
don't.
right? But here I am, stupid me. I'm holding my bow up, pointed in the direction of the bull. And then I remembered, hey, stupid, you got a compound. Maybe you should draw back. So I yanked that thing back right as his eyes came around that tree. And then it was nothing but thinking, right? Then it was a strategy game. So now I'm at full draw. I'm following him through the opening, and I'm having to look ahead of him because the brush is too tall in front of me. This is 12,000 feet elevation, and it's steep. Doesn't look that steep in the video, but it is steep. I had to kick a hole for my back foot so I had something level to put it on. And luckily, I had enough experience to do that, so I wasn't on super unstable footing, because when I actually killed that bull, I was on my tippy toes. Mm-hmm. Because when he got to the little dip in the brush where I was going to stop him, I was going to give him the yo to stop him, but he starts raking the tree at 15 yards. I'm like, okay. And so, but I'm looking down, you know, I'm shooting my compound bare bow with a release. So I'm looking right down my arrow, and I'm looking at it, I'm like, I'm not going to make it over that brush. So I had to stand up on my tippy toes. So luckily I had dug that flat spot out. So you can see it in the video. I stand up and my arrow comes up just a little bit to the level that I needed to where I could shoot him. But thoughts are not thinking. If we can just get people to realize that.
Let's hover on that a little bit. So I want to just dig into you a little bit, if you don't mind. Obviously you have a high or head. You're a sniper, right? You were a sniper.
I was. Yeah, I retired in April of 22. I retired from the SWAT.
Oh, you retired in 22. Okay, I think that was just after I'd spent time with you. That must be the experiences that you've had in that line of work would only be a benefit in being able to take your mind out of the noisy part and get to the thinking part, right? Mm-hmm. So would you say that for people to practice, to train in order to be in that situation with that giant elk in front of them and get their mind into thinking, that they should be putting their mind into those situations as much as possible so that they're able to train themselves to do it?
I say all the time that you cannot take the same body with you. So you must take the same mind. Because your body, when you step on the line in Vegas or you've got a giant bull or a giant buck in front of you, is physiologically changed in ways that you have no control of. You cannot control how much adrenaline is dumped into your system.
Yeah.
The only thing you can control in those problems or in that situation, that becomes a cerebral problem. So the first mental game that must be played with a cerebral problem, be that anxiety, anger management, or just absolute shaking like a dog crapping tacks because it's a giant bull in front of you, the first mental game that has to be played is breathing, because that's one of the only things you can control. So you do whatever breathing technique you do. I really like the one from Andrew Huberman now where you breathe in through your nose to the top and then you go extra
and okay
and out through the mouth and evidently that expels more carbon dioxide. I've found it to work very well. I found it to work better than combat breathing, which is box breathing, you know, into the nose for four, hold for four, out through mouth for four, hold that just I yawn every time I even explain it, so
I just yawned.
So that breathing technique, what that does, it lowers your heart rate so that you can access your prefrontal cortex. Because if you don't lower your heart rate, the volume of thoughts will always overtake you. So you have to practice getting loud in your own head. And so I was training the Phillies a couple weeks ago, and this one pitcher says, "What do you mean get loud in my own head?" And I didn't answer his question. I looked at the coaches, and I'm like, if he's asking that question, you've never put him in a situation where he had to get loud.
Yeah.
Like, when's the last time you pitched a bullpen and you had 10 other pitchers standing around the mound yelling at you? It just causes an increase in the volume of thoughts. So you have to get reps in increasing the volume of your thinking. So in your shooting practice shooting on one foot. So you replicate the symptoms of the adrenaline. You replicate the shaking. You replicate lack of footing, a loss of balance. So you get reps in bringing your mind back out of this huge aim that you now see. and out of this balance problem that you now have. Because when you go to fall over, you're going to have to put your foot down. That becomes priority number one for your mind. So you have to then regain your balance, pick your foot back up, and stick your conscious mind back into your trigger work. You do that with here I go. Always that decision that increases presence. So like everybody at the big Vegas tournament is sitting there on the practice line and they're just, you know, they're shooting hundreds of arrows on the practice line. And then they go to shoot their scored arrows and like, man, I shake so much and I'm so nervous and this and that. I'm like, have you ever practiced for that? And they're like, no. I said, maybe you should get on the line and shoot on one foot. Because then when you see this big aim, when they say this is your first scoring end, right? You've seen that shake a million times and you know how to bring your conscious mind out of it. And so that's, people just don't practice getting loud in their own head. They practice, they don't make their practice harder than the actual game. Which so
is harder than the game, yeah.
It'd be real similar, like Joel, Joel and I teach a hunting course together, and and these are brand new hunters. A lot of these people have never harvested an animal, killed anything. And we're sending them out to do their first pig hunt. And we do, we make sure that they do an accuracy test. And we make them, you know, exert some physical energy and do some, you know, some burpees or run up this hill and then take the shot, you know, because we want to see them in that situation to where they can't do nothing but breathe hard and try to concentrate on their, you know, what they have at hand, and that's making the shot.
Yeah, and it simulates it very accurately, especially they all seem to say, yeah, the exercise is one thing, but having the whole group standing in silence watching me, that was tough.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, both of them are just problems, right? They're just an increase in the volume of thoughts.
Yeah.
So anything you can do to increase the volume of your shooters or your player or whatever, get the volume of their thoughts very high. That's why I mess with people when they're shooting, right? I grab their bow and literally shake the hell out of it while they're shooting. And they'll look at me like, do you want me to shoot? I'm like, yeah, I want you to shoot a perfect trigger press on this or whatever, you know, whatever system they're shooting. All while I'm shaking their bow more than they've ever seen before. It instantly makes their thought volume increase. So they have to increase the volume of their thinking, right?
Now, Joel, there's obviously a lot of people that in with their mental situation, they're probably hard on themselves, would probably put it, be a nice way to put it. They don't have a level of self-confidence that they probably would like to have. And that stems in everything they do in life. I imagine that, well, number one, that it's going to be hard for people like that to have to get their mind in that place of confidence. And I want to use that word for a little bit, confidence, because I'm kind of, to me, I see there's a hand-in-hand relationship between that self-talk, you know, that thinking and confidence, because you kind of need to have one with the other. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And it comes from knowing how you do what you do. Like, I know exactly how I'm going to shoot my next bull elk. That is very powerful to have that knowledge. I know I'm going to draw back and aim. I know I'm going to set my tension. I know I'm going to say, here I go. And I know I'm going to work myself through my shot execution.
And
there's
because
no
you've
mystery
got this,
to it. And that's where the confidence comes from.
Yeah.
By that's where you eliminate the mystery. People that are not confident, they're not confident because they don't know how it's going to go. They don't know how that game is going to be played. They don't know if they're going to make their free throws. They don't know if they're going to make their penalty kicks. They don't know. And if they don't know how they do it, how can you possibly get confidence? Because even if you gain success and you're really good at something, again, if you don't know how you do it, you're going to have a bad day.
And this is so true. This does apply to everything in life. I mean, if you like, just to use a couple other analogies, like if you can blueprint everything that you do in life, let's just pick diet and your physical, let's just say your physical weight. Yep. Well, if you can blueprint, if I eat exactly this and that and this at a certain time of day for weeks and months, I am going to get down to a certain weight where I want to be. if I hit the gym and I do this and that, I'm gonna build X amount of muscle, I'm gonna lose X amount of fat. Like there is a blueprint that if you follow, if you're dedicated and disciplined and you follow the blueprint, you're gonna get the results. And so this, what I'm picking up is your life, you apply your whole life to these blueprints. Would I be correct in saying that?
Absolutely.
And that's where you get this Joel Turner confidence from.
Yeah. So if you get, you have, let's say you've blueprinted your diet, right? And it's not that you've physically blueprinted your diet, it's that you've mentally blueprinted the diet. So when the donut shows up, a donut is a problem. A donut increases the volume of your thoughts. Man, that donut would taste so good right now. That has no instruction and no strategy, right? So
Absolutely.
your thinking has to increase. The volume of your thing is like, no, I'm not going to eat that donut, right? I'm not doing it. Where do you need to put your conscious mind? You need to put it in the fact that you're not going to eat that donut. When do you need to put it there? When you see the donut. How do you put it there? Speech, right? So you can take virtually any problem in life and you can plug it into the mental game equation.
Man, it's so powerful.
So then
Yeah.
once you start to do that equation and see the results of the process, then you build the confidence.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know exactly how you're going to do what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Be that whatever it is in your life that you need to deal with, whatever problem you're having, you conquer it. Like I was dealing with a lady the other day, and she was having massive panic attacks. And I've trained this lady in shooting before. And she was having these almost debilitating panic attacks. She would cry, it would increase her heart rate, just like actual anxiety attacks. And so I asked her if she would call me, and she did. And when I trained her in shooting, she was shooting a compound and she was locked way off target. Like she was locked, her pin was feet off of the target, and she would hold way low and then she would yip up and punch the trigger at the same time, right? So we gained control of that. I put her through the Shot IQ stuff. She gained control of it, no problem. And we would joke. I'm like, I don't want to see that crazy lady. And she's like, no way, I hate that crazy lady, right? And I'm like, okay. So now this was a couple of years ago. And then I get this phone call from her, and she'd been having these panic attacks for several months. And she was seeing professionals and this and that for, like 3 times a week. And I said, once you started these panic attacks, I said, you stopped shooting your bow, didn't you? She goes, yeah, I haven't touched my bow since I started these panic attacks. I said, you need to go shoot your bow. She's like, I don't want to go shoot my bow. I'm like, because every time you control a shot, you overcome a miniature anxiety attack. Every archery shot is an anxiety attack. It's exactly what is going on, but it's just an anxiety attack in a big world is like if you're almost debilitated in an anxiety attack. I said, okay, so let's treat it as a cerebral problem. I need you to shoot your bow because you're going to gain confidence in that because you know how to control your shot. You're not going to let the crazy lady in anymore. You're going to draw back and aim. Then you're going to address your trigger. Then you're going to say, here I go. Then you're going to talk yourself through your trigger work. She goes, yeah, I remember all that stuff. I'm like, okay, I need you to go do that. But if you have a panic attack, like a real full-blown panic attack, here's what you're going to do. First, it's a cerebral problem. So we know the first mental game that has to be played is breathing. So she gains control of her breathing, right? Now, once she has control of her breathing, the volume of her thoughts may still be deafening. So what I'm finding out is that anxiety attacks are nothing more than a loss of perspective. Like you literally lost perspective on what's really happening, the reality of a situation, because anxiety attack is nothing more than a fear thought driven event, right? So what I had her do is once she gains control of her breathing, the next mental game equation she's going to plug into is where does she need her conscious mind? She needs it in zooming out. Zooming out, like big picture. You need to zoom out away and look at your life with a different lens. Do you have a roof over your head? Yes. Do you have nice vehicles? Yes. Do you have two great kids? Yes. Is anybody shooting at you right now? No, they are not. Right? So just gaining just a hair, just a minuscule hair of perspective will get you out of that anxiety attack. So you either say zoom out or you say big picture, right? To get yourself to get this other lens in front of your eyes and go,
Yeah, kind of ground you.
wait a minute, this is not actually happening. I don't need to be so freaked out about this. And then if you need to lower your heart rate more to get more thinking, you know how to do that with your breathing technique. So it's just one mental game after the next. They're all different. They all have different values for whatever your problem is, but it's all the same equation.
Man,
That's
Joel,
amazing.
were you like this as a kid? Were you like,
No.
did your when did this deep introspective part of you like start to come through that you remember?
It came through when I became a cop.
Okay.
When I became a cop, I was not that great of a shot. I was fixing mental problems with mechanical means. Like, I wasn't going to do well in firearms in the academy, but shooting is my world. It's what I was known for. And not because I was good, just that I did a lot of it, right? And so I got in the academy and I knew that. Are you still there, guys?
Yep.
I just got a. Says can't update Chrome. Hang on one second.
Yep. No big deal.
Yeah, no problem. We can just edit
I
it
don't
out.
see you guys anymore.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Yeah.
But you can hear us.
Yeah. I can hear you. So are we still good then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm in the academy and I'm a trigger yanking nightmare. So what I did is I bought a 1911 pistol with a much shorter trigger stroke in it. So even though I would punch the trigger, it wouldn't deviate my point of impact as much. Right?
Oh.
So I end up,
Oh
by the
no.
end of the academy, I end up taking first in my class in firearms because I started to get some control of myself. But it just, 2 years into being a cop, the same year I got on the SWAT team, I became a firearms instructor. And getting on the SWAT team was the catalyst for it all because it scared the crap out of me that I was not going to be able to perform. Like I was going to yank the trigger in a hostage rescue or something like that in some type of tactical situation. And it scared me enough to go, I have to figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
But it wasn't out there, it didn't exist. So I had to like find the sciences that your mind deals with in shooting. And once I was able to do that, and I packaged those sciences of neurolinguistic programming, open and closed loop control systems, visual proprioception, I packaged them up. And then that's when I started to actually teach it, gain control of my own shooting, and then gaining, helping others gain control of their shot. And the more I taught it, and the more I taught it, the more I understood exactly what was going on. And then being in actual situations like a hostage rescue, I've been in four hostage rescues now. But just being in those situations and blueprinting how I was successful, and then going, okay, this is the difference between those early years when I didn't know how I did what I did. And really understanding the science of the mind and how it works in high stress shooting events. And because we've really mastered the archery shot, that's how we're able to master all this other stuff pretty easily. Because shooting a controlled archery shot, especially with a stick bow, is the top of the top. It is the top of the concentration chain. And we do it, if you're shooting a lot, you're doing it hundreds of times a day.
Is that what drives you to the stick bow? The challenge, the fact that it is the
Absolutely. It is.
hardest mentally to.
Absolutely. Now, there's another level. There's Bodie Turner level, right, of compound shooting.
Yeah, we want to talk
And
about that too.
yeah, I am almost to Bodie's level. I don't believe I will ever get to Bodhi's level. Like, I'll
And
shoot up.
can I just insert quickly for the listeners, Bodhi,
Sure.
that's your son, and he is currently the world champion. Am I correct?
Well, he's world champion in several different disciplines, but like this year he won the Vegas shoot, which is the biggest indoor tournament in the world. He won that in the pro division at 15.
Wow. And this is
Youngest.
competitive archery, just in case anyone didn't catch on that.
Yeah, youngest male to ever do that. And now, like, he shot a couple of 660s which at Lancaster, which is a perfect qualification round. He's won Lancaster, which is the second biggest indoor tournament in the world. He's won that the last 2 years. And this year's Lancaster shoot-off, if your listeners haven't watched that, go watch that in the men's or the pro open division, and you'll see Bodhi shoot 9 12 rings in a row. He never missed a ring that he was shooting at. A 12 ring is smaller than a way smaller than a dime, and it's out in the 7 8 ring. So if you miss it, you get a 7 or an 8.
Oh, okay.
But if you hit it, you get a 12. So people are starting to use that as a strategy. And Bodhi, it was amazing. It's one of the greatest archery shoot-offs in the world. But when I
So
shoot a compound, it's
obviously he's made you very proud, but I think the thing I'm really interested to know is, like, I think it goes without saying that your process has had its hand in it, but how much do you think there is to play in the fact that he's just his natural ability, or mental ability, physical ability has given him an advantage, or would you say none?
none. Well, very little. I mean, he's been a controlled shooter since he was 3 years old. Like, when I watched him punch a trigger for the first time at the age of 3, I mean, he started shooting a bow at 10 and a half months old. He was a baby.
Yeah, my son was one.
Yeah. And so at 3 years old, I bought him his first little compound and his little index finger trigger, and he punched the crap out of that thing because that's what his mind is built for. And so I had him shoot a resistance activated release. And this is a note for parents that are trying to get their kids into archery. If you're going to have them shoot a release aid, don't mess around. Do not send them down the wrong path. Just have them shoot a resistance release and make them work through it. It's got a safety on it. So when you push the safety in, you draw back and aim. After the aim is done, you take the safety off, which teaches them to mentally separate from the aim. And they say, "Here I go." They may not know what they're doing, but you have them say, "Here I go," to up their presence. And then you have them talk themselves through a pull, because if you don't pull, it's not going off. So you show that you have them show you how slow can you pull, and you can set that release to where they have to work very hard to make it go off. And it just sets them on the right path. So that's the path that Bodhi has been on. And then, a couple of years later of doing that thousands of times, he can now shoot any release he wants. So I'll share a story with you on his ability. So this year in Lancaster, it's the final match. He has worked himself through two shooters at this point, hasn't missed a ring that he shot at, and he goes up against one of the world's best. The nickname of this guy is Mr. Perfect. But we know the science of every pro shot. I can tell you to the nth degree the science of what happens in their shot, be it good or bad. So we know this guy's going to miss eventually. We know he's going to miss, and he's going to miss low, because that's what happens when he gets in high stress. Because, I mean, this guy is all over the internet. He's all over the world. He's a phenomenal shooter. But he has one hiccup that when he puts his thumb on the button slowly, it means that he's going to punch it. And that's going to result in a low arrow. So before I saw that happen, I'm watching Bodhi shoot. I'm in the coach's box. And Bodhi draws back and aims on this shot, and he's shooting for an 11 ring on this one, so center of the gold. And he draws back and aims, and then he presses to the click on the release, and then it's taken too long. I'm back there going, "Oh, come on, boy. Come on, boy." Right? Reach into the toolbox. And so what he did when he and then he eventually shot the shot. He couldn't let it down. He didn't have enough time. So he
Oh,
shot
there's a
the
time
shot.
constraint on the shot?
What's that? Oh
Is
yeah.
it there's a time constraint?
You have 30 seconds.
Oh, interesting.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, so he had 10 seconds left when he finally reaches into the toolbox. So not enough
Okay.
to slide down and start over.
Yeah.
So he shoots the shot. It's a dead center 11. And later I go, what was up with that one shot? And he goes, man, I noticed that my release hand was shaking like crazy on that shot. Problem, right? Red flag goes
Yeah.
up. It's an increase in the volume of thoughts. So there he is. He draws back and aims. He said the aim is very good. Then he presses the click, and then he's like, oh man, my hand's shaking. That statement has no instruction. It has no strategy. It's a thought. Thoughts do not solve problems. The problem is you need to shoot this shot, and it's got to be controlled or you're going to miss the ring. So what's he do? He recognizes the problem, recognizes that the volume of his thoughts are too loud, so he manually increases the volume of his thinking. Now he reaches into his toolbox, his mental toolbox, and he pulls out the word squeeze, right? Because that's how he activates his release. So he's, oh my God, my hand's shaking. Oh, no. Here I go to up his presence, right? That's the big presence reset. Here I go, squeeze until the shot breaks. So that's his ability is to understand problems, and he has the toolbox to fix them no matter what.
Man, that's incredible. So not only is he set up to be just a legend of a competitive archer, but this is going to set him up for life, right?
Oh yeah,
To
absolutely.
be a good person, make good decisions, blueprint his life.
For sure.
I'm excited for him. I'm sure you're excited to see what kind of man he becomes in the future.
Yeah.
How do
Absolutely.
you so Cole, this was your question.
Yeah, I was curious, but you kind of explained it because I was curious at being such a like where he's at with his archery, right? Being as good as he is, was there a point in there where you didn't, or were you, man, it's hard to ask the question because he's been doing it his whole life, Joel, and it's not, was it ever something that you were like, this is a discipline for you, or was this all on him? Like he's
Yeah,
just loved it his whole life?
did he ever burn out or potentially burn out that you had to push him
No,
through or?
I've never pushed him. If he said tomorrow that he doesn't want to shoot his bow anymore, then so be it. We go a different direction. You can't push people into this, but archery has been my life since I was 7 years old. So for 40 years, I've been shooting a bow and I still shoot my bow every day. I was talking to somebody today at the 3D tournament. I'm like, I bet there, since I was 7 years old, I bet there are less than 50 days in my life that I haven't shot a bow. And I love it. And so, lucky for me, my boy loves it. And he realized, I started him off shooting bare bow so that he got to see the trajectory path of the arrow. He got to see the flight of the arrow. And we always shot balloons and stuff that breaks and whatever, active targets. That's how you hook kids
Make
into
it fun.
shooting, right? You make it fun and you don't worry about, their form and all this other stuff. You just get them so that they have mental control of their shot, and that's what sets their path in life,
Any
not
other
archery, but in life.
recommendations? Because it's funny that you bring that up. So my son has been shooting since he was one, and when he was like 2 and 3, he just loved doing it with me. He's now 6, almost 7, and he's sort of got all sorts of other things that he's focused on. And he'll come and shoot every now and then, but he's not in love with it. And I really would love him to be passionate about it. And I'm sure at some
Does
point
he
he'll get there, but.
hunt? Does he hunt with you? Can he hunt with you at that age?
I mean, we've hunted rabbits together, and he really enjoys that. But yeah, that is my goal, especially now that he's becoming more physically capable of heading out on some hunts. That is the plan, and he will enjoy that.
Do you have an age limit in Oregon?
Yeah, for him to legally hunt, he has to be 12.
And that is the most absurd law I have ever heard of. So in Washington, and it's the same law in many states in the West, in Washington, there's no age limit. So
Really?
Bodie killed his first blacktail buck at 6
What? No way.
with a crossbow, with a crossbow in a rifle season in a firearms restriction area. Bodie killed his first buck with a crossbow.
Wow.
And he killed his first Pope and Young blacktail buck by himself with his bow when he was 10.
That's awesome.
He stalked it and killed it. I wasn't even home. I was at work. He stalked it and killed this thing with his bow, shot it at 35 yards. And it's a Pope and Young 3-point.
Wow.
That's cool.
So, and it's just been on since then. And, you know, I mean, having me around, being able to call in elk like a chicken on a string, it works out pretty good for him, you know? So
what a fantastic experience for both of you. You know, it's something to, I mean, this is, I think, what most hunting fathers dream of is to have that kind of relationship.
I am literally living the dream. And people say that all the time, but I'm like, nah, I don't think so. I am actually living the dream.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Joel, you talked about elk hunting. I want you to maybe touch, I'm just such a huge fan of elk hunting. And 10 years ago, I pretty much devoted every September of the rest of my life to archery elk hunting, if I can get a tag anywhere. But man, could you talk to, what do you see the most on, do you think guys fail most? Is it their mental game, or is it calling, or is it their shot? Where do you see a lot of these guys going wrong, man? Because I know we're going to have a lot of people that's going to listen, that's going to be in the elk community. And it just blows my mind that the amount of hunters we have flooding into the woods and we still can't get any better success rates than the 10%.
So it's a twofold problem. Number one is calling. And then when it comes to the shot, they play the wrong mental game because they've literally practiced their own failure. Now the calling is the easy part because calling doesn't cause your body impact. It's just knowledge, right? So, but people don't humanize their elk calling. They're trying to sound like an elk, talk like an elk, but we don't know what the heck the elk are saying, but we do know some things, right? I learned how to call elk in from watching drunk human beings in bar fights. That's how I learned how to kill bulls. Because if I told you, now, have you watched any of my elk calling stuff, Cole?
I have.
So have you heard about the bull calling cow's bugle?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so you understand the bar scene.
Oh, yeah. I actually love your analogy with the bar scene, and I use it quite often.
Right. So just for your listeners, if they haven't seen that, it's if I asked another male, if me and another male were standing at the doorway of the bar, and I said, okay, Cole, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to go in the bar and get punched by another male. You cannot use your hands. You can only use your words. You have 30 seconds. Ready, go. What's your strategy? And what most people that I ask this question to, they go into the bar and they talk to a male. They insult a male. And when you do that, it depends on that other male's attitude, whether he punches you in the face or not. But if you go into the bar and you just observe and you find a female that's definitely with a male, you go and you say inappropriate things to her, you will find yourself in a fight 100% of the time in any country in this world. You don't even have to speak the right language. Dude's going to pick up on your vibe.
Yeah.
So what does that mean in the elk calling world? That means if you want to go into the bar and speak only to the females, you have to cut the chuckles off of your bugle, because chuckling is one of the things that human beings seem to want to do all the time. But chuckling in the elk world is a bull-to-bull communication. As soon as you do a bull-to-bull communication, you depend on that bull's attitude, whether he comes to fight you or not.
A bull, like calling it, welcoming in another bull, correct to define
that? It's usually a challenge.
Oh, challenge or a friendly, can it mean both?
There is no friendly bugles with chuckles. They're always, it's a challenge bugle. And that's what most human beings are doing, is they're walking around in the woods, bugling with chuckling at the end of it. and they're talking to the bulls. If you want the bull to come fight you, now, yes, you're going to call in some bulls like that, but you ain't going to call in 54 of them. I guarantee you that, right? So instead of walking around the woods talking to the bulls, you walk around the woods, and if you get close to a herd, a bull with cows, you just entered the bar. So you get close to the cows and you bugle at them with no chuckles, just a short, raspy bugle, no chuckles. Bull calling cows bugle. You're talking directly to the females. He has no option but to remove you from the bar. So he will come and try to kill you. So when that bull comes to kill you, that's when people screw up because now they have increased adrenaline, increased respiration, increased perspiration, all of the physiological changes that you have no control over. So the bull comes in and you get your shot, you draw your bow back, the volume of your thoughts is deafening. Oh my God, that's a giant. I'm going to be a hero. I already know I'm going to put him right here on the wall. What was the distance again? Heap sight. Never heard of her, right? So you've completely blow out any of your shot process, and your subconscious will run it for you. But it's going to make you so efficient that you're not going to hit where you want to hit at, like, not at all. So understanding that thoughts aren't thinking, and what mental game you need to play, and the blueprint of your shot, and your determination that you're going to do it that way, no matter what, even if that bull walks out of your sight picture. So that's for bulls with cows. That's how you kill herd bulls. You get close to cows, you do a short, raspy bugle with no chuckles, and he will remove you from the bar. Now, if he doesn't have cows, you got to understand that males will choose younger females. If everything is left to, there's no societal limits. Do we go after an 18-year-old or do we go after a 60-year-old female? Right? If it's just for the fact of making babies, we go after the younger females. Elk do the same thing, right? So, and you have to understand suspicion rates. So if you're standing in a room and you hear an adult female scream outside, that increases your suspicion. It doesn't make you run out of the room. You're going to go to the door. You're going to open the door. You're going to peek your head outside and see if that's old Tweaker Jane again, right? If you hear an adult male screaming outside, even higher suspicion rate, right? But if you hear a baby crying outside, you will exit your house. You will exit your safety to help that baby, right?
Absolutely.
So that's why you don't do mature cow sounds ever in the elk woods. The two
Yep.
most common
That's one thing
sounds,
I've taken from you for sure.
yeah, the two most common sounds made by human beings are challenge bugles, so a bugle with chuckles, and cow sounds. When was the last time that a human female got together with all of her girlfriends, all of her little clique there, and she spoke nicely about another female that wants to procreate with her man? Doesn't happen. So if you do cow sounds, you are a sexual threat to cows. And if you do mature cow sounds, you're a sexual threat to bulls too, because they're looking for the young ones, right? Bulls are pedophiles through and through. So you play on that instinct, not their attitude. You play on that instinct. And you do, like, if you're moving through an area, you don't know if there's elk there or not, you don't do cow sounds. You don't do challenge bugles. You do lost calf sounds. It's a sexually neutral sound. And everybody wants to help a calf.
Makes so much sense.
It does.
So
It does make so
you
much sense.
sound check these areas before you go into them. And you will pull responses out of elk. It's like they can't help it. They have to respond. The bull will do a bull call and cows bugle to try to call you into the herd. The cows will mew. Sometimes the cows will come in. If a bull doesn't have any cows, he's coming in. If a bull bugles twice in the same spot, what does that tell you?
Telling you to come over.
No. If a bull bugles twice from the same spot,
He's got cows.
he's got cows. So you know how to kill him. Now you just got to get quiet, slide in there, get within 100 yards of the cows, bull call and cows bugle. If a bull bugles once, he moves and bugles again, he doesn't have cows.
Yep.
But now you just keep on with the calf sounds, and here's the cool part about calf sounds. There's no hang-up spot. That's
true.
The cool part about the bull call and cows bugle. There's no hang-up spot with either of those techniques. I do not deal with hung-up bulls ever. They come right in, very close. Right? So just lost calf, he's going to bugle to you, cool. You do maybe another lost calf series, he bugles, he's closer. You don't have to do anything else. He's coming. He'll probably start mewing. When a bull mews to you, he is fully committed to the relationship with that calf.
How are you approaching like early season with these type of calls? Same thing, no difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. If a bull, I mean, once a bull gets out of velvet, it's testosterone that killed the that told the blood to stop going to the antlers.
Yeah.
So they're ready to go. August 17th around here, bulls are hard horned.
Yeah.
You can calf call them in like a chicken on a string, and then as soon as they get cows, oh man, it's the bull calling cows bugle.
I'm gonna have to rethink my chuckles now, because like the
every elk caller that comes to me, you know, especially the competition callers, right? They're like, okay, can you listen to my chuckle? I've been working on my chuckle. I'm like, yeah, I can listen to your chuckle for stage work, but if you do that in the elk woods, no bueno.
Okay, so Joel, you know, like this last year was the first year I've hunted for Roosevelts, and I noticed that the Roosevelts chuckle a lot. I mean, maybe it's just my little observation, but I just feel like in general, and I hunted several units, they chuckle a lot. And I did perceive them, like if I was to read the emotion, I did perceive the emotion as aggression. I perceived it more as a, we're over here, come on over.
Nah, that's not what you're saying.
Okay.
Well, bugling with chuckles is a bull-to-bull communication. If they chuckled to you, that means that you made some type of bull sound.
Yes, I did. I bugled.
You bugled. Did you bugle with chuckles or no?
No, I bugled, just a bugle. They chuckled back with no bugle, just a chuckle.
Okay, so it's a bull-to-bull communication. So what happens is with Rosies is the bull densities are very low. So, you know, and the terrain is very steep. It's very brushy. It's just the density and the competition is not that high for the cows. So when you bugle, like if, were you just hadn't made any elk sounds, didn't know if there was any elk there, and you did a bugle with no chuckles?
No, I knew he was there. I'd seen him before I even bugled. He had cows with him. Yep. Perfect.
So did you call him in and kill him?
Nope, I got pretty close, but what happened was I made the mistake of throwing in some cow calls.
Oh gosh. That's the biggest mistake made, because you get I'll just do a couple cows.
Because then the cows took him.
Cows took him away. Literally took him away.
Yep.
And
they do it every time.
You know,
never ever, ever make mature cow sounds in the elk woods. I haven't made a mature cow sound in the last 7 or 8 years. The calls that I use now, you can't even get to the cow spectrum.
Man, that makes so much sense.
It makes so much sense.
This year in New Mexico, I just hammered. We had a screwed up situation with a bull, and then I just hammered on calf calls, like lost calf call. And I mean, I was persistent with it and just almost obnoxious. And my partner Eric, he was like, man, that sounds so good. He's like, something's got it. And I mean, just in that nick of time, here that bull that we'd blown out, he comes right back in, right after the freaking calf sounds. And I never made a cow call. It was all calf, just straight up. And I mean, super persistent. Yeah, 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 yeah. You know, just acting like I was frantic.
On the end of your call, if that's where people dip into the cow spectrum and it kills it.
Yeah, it's real short and quick.
Short and quick.
Quick is very high pitched.
Yes.
But Joel, I want to dive into your lost calf call. So if we like just think of those stereotypical, like that, those the cadence is very fast, but the calls are very short. But you've got a There's almost like a raspiness to the end, and you draw it out a little bit. Could you explain the effect of that?
So it's just using your voice. I call it a voice mew. So you're just adding some gurr sound to it. And when you listen to calves, calves make sounds with almost every breath, especially if they're lost. So it's not that they're not going meow, 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 right? It's right, and they will double it. A lot of times they will double it, and that's where. And then you can voice mew a few times. Just emotion is the key.
Yeah,
that's where a lot of external calls people have trouble putting emotion into them. But in a mouth read, you can put the emotion. That is, I believe that is why I call in so many bulls. Yeah. I'm doing all biologically correct sounds. I am never pushing elk in a different direction other than to me.
It's awesome.
Okay. Oh man, it's fantastic stuff. Dude,
we've knocked out a pretty good podcast here, you guys.
We've kind of touched on a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Oh man, I'm not gonna be able to go to bed for hours now. Just thinking about it.
I'm gonna have to go get the spotlight out and go shoot my bow.
There you go.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I thank you for that, Joel, because it's not only do you know you pass on all this fabulous information, but it's inspiring. Like I want to go out and I want to shoot my bow better. I want to go out and I want to focus more and be more intentional, not just with my shot, but with everything I do.
Right.
I want to go out there and I want to call elk. I want to be better at calling elk.
Yep.
I want to be more patient in the blacktail woods. Mm-hmm. You know, I just thank you for all the inspiration that you provide to all of us. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Awesome. Awesome time, man. I had such a good time talking to you, Joel. Really appreciate you coming on. And I'm going to have to come up there and we're going to have to do a little blacktail clinic or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
So if you guys, look at my new website, it's called turnermodel.com.
Turnermodel.com.
It is one of the coolest websites that you'll ever see. It is really cool how it
I will go and look at that.
Scrolling through that thing, it's got more movement, more stuff going on. It's really awesome. So
turnermodel.com.
Yep, turnermodel.com.
ShotIQ still?
Yeah, the online courses are ShotIQ.com, and then there's a new online course called MindIQ.com. Mm. So both all that stuff is available on Turner Model if you go to courses on that. And but you know, there's still the old ShotIQ.com is there as well. And
to follow Joel on Instagram, there are
It's Joel Turner Actual.
Joel Turner Actual. There are some nuggets that you will experience, especially during hunting season, that you will want to see. Absolutely. Yeah. And some of those videos, I mean, you've posted, I think, maybe 30-second video of you just like doing that last calf call. I can't tell you how I've saved it to the phone and I'll be up in the elk woods and I'll literally play it in the morning just to refresh my memory on how I want to sound.
That's great.
I think that thing gets played a lot during elk season. I get a lot of requests for that clip. So,
but anything else you'd like to listeners to know? You know, you've got your websites there. Your any other social media? Anything?
No, that's all of it. I just want people to realize that thoughts are not thinking. That's the start of it all.
That's my biggest takeaway. Definitely from this chat, and I thank you for that. It's going to change my game, Cole. I think it's going to change yours too.
Yep, absolutely. Great podcast. Hopefully, we didn't lose everybody there at the first 15 minutes of it talking blacktail. But y'all know how Joel and I are. All of us, Joel and Cole. If it's bow hunting, we're gonna talk it loud and proud. Thank you, everybody. Such a great show. Can't thank you guys both for being here. And I think this is an awesome episode. And
Yeah, find us at bushsurvivaltraining.com or learnhuntharvest.com. That's where you can reach us if you want to give us any recommendations, questions, shout at us, whatever you want to say. We're open books.
Yeah. Make Instagram. Sure and hit the subscribe button here for the podcast, and you guys go leave us a 5-star review.
But please tell one friend, just one friend, tell them about the podcast and help us grow.
Yep. Perfect. Sweet. Thanks, y'all.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Abami zetu akwete mayanda ame asanza tina akamasi kwata nitasi kwata pema ukuwa maukwa ishi.